Greetings, everybody. Welcome to episode 10 of Mandatory Marvel and DC, the show that likes to take a look back at the biggest and best storylines from the big two of comics. I'm your host, Max Byrne, and I hope you'll continue to join me each and every episode as we cover these classic moments that have stood the test of time and crossed over into popular culture. Now, after a little bit of a hiatus, we are finally back with our 10th episode, so double figures are upon us. So to mark this auspicious occasion, I'm delighted to say that I'm joined once again by the transatlantic titan, the force of nature from Florida, the host of the amazing Indie Comics Spotlight show here on Comics in Motion. It's the American Ninja himself, Mr. Tony Farina. Hi, yes, Tony. How are you doing, sir?
Max, I love that I'm the American Ninja. I mean, listen, Dudikoff, as I'm just going to shout it out because it's made us somewhat internet famous, we were going back and forth with John Hammond about the American Ninja quadrilogy that you have. Yeah. And Michael Dudikoff liked the conversation. So we are officially... Maybe we officially now work for Canon Films. I'm not sure, but that was pretty cool.
Yeah. I think I've topped up the owners of Canon's pension fund in these last few weeks, the amount of Canon Films I've acquired. So, that's a conversation for another show, I think.
Another show.
But it's great to have you on, Tony. I'm very grateful that you're the first guest on this return of the show after a few weeks' break. So, thank you again so much for
I'm happy to. Well, this is, you and I had talked about doing this one pre-break, so I'm glad we came back to it, and I'm excited to dig in.
Me too. So obviously you're a regular guest on the show, and people who might not know that the topic of conversation is always the choice of the guest, not mine. So do you want to tell people what you've selected for us this evening?
Yes, so we are going to do the 2003 Neil Gaiman, Andy Kubert, kind of Elseworlds, I guess in Marvel it was called What If, Marvel 1602.
And what a choice you've come up with. I absolutely love this book. I suppose that's revealing my hand a bit early saying I love it, but we'll come to that. But yeah, like you said, 1602, Gaiman and Kubert, covers by Scott McCohen, which we'll get to as well in a bit, because I want to talk about the way he did those covers, which are superb. Like you said, 2003, 8-issue miniseries, ran from, I think, the back end of 2003 through to sort of the middle part of 2004. So it's kind of straddled both years there. And like you say, this is a really interesting book. It's a What If, an Elseworlds story that sort of reimagines the golden age of the Marvel Universe as being set in, well, as the title gives it away, 1602, Elizabethan England. So, I mean, you know, quite a departure from what you might expect. So before we sort of delve into where the book came from and the sort of ifs and ands of the book, what's your personal sort of relationship with this one, Tony? Did you buy it on release, or is it one you came to sort of after the event, or, you know, how did you come across this particular title?
Yeah, it was an after event. So in 2003, 2004, my kids were 3 and 4.
Yeah.
I was finishing up a divorce from their mother. And at that time, it was in that dark period where I wasn't reading comics. Cause honestly, I just didn't have two nickels to rub together. So, you know, we've all been through that stretch where we just weren't reading comics, even though we thought about comics. And it was before Hoopla Digital, where you can get them free from your libraries, or even before a lot of libraries were binding the books, you know, like would get the trades and put them in as, like, you know, regular books you could get. So it was just, I was kind of in that dead spot. So then I'd say it was maybe 2012, 2013, I was actually at the library, and it was just kind of one of those days where I was there by myself, and I just wandered over to the graphic novel section, as I was wont to do, knowing I have this gap in my reading history. You know, there was like maybe 5 or 10 years where it just was out of the loop. And so, you know, it was really just a shelf read. I was just looking through, and there's a book. It's called Marvel 1602. I'm like, well, that sounds cool. And then I see who wrote it, Neil himself, and Andy Kubert, who did those mid-80s, early 90s Wolverine issues. So I was like, well, whatever this is, I'm going to read it, not even knowing what it was. So I just grabbed it as the trade. And that was the first time I read it. And as a history nerd, as somebody who loves history, I I was just blown away by this book. So that's how I came to it, was just truly a happy accident.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I didn't pick it up as it was released back in 03, 04. I wasn't really buying stuff on a regular basis myself then either. So I've worked it out. It was about 2012, maybe 2013 when I got this as part of a like subscription service we have in the UK here for sort of Marvel graphic novels that I subscribe to, that I'm still subscribing to actually. And it came as one of those in a nice sort of collected hardcover. And what a book it is. I mean, like we said, it's so dense and there's so much going on, so much meat on the bone. It really is a something to get your teeth into. I mean, where do you sit normally on sort of Elseworlds style stories, what if stories? Are you a big fan of when they take existing characters and throw them into a complete reimagining or completely different continuity? Or do you prefer where they, you know, the status quo, the mainstream continuity, so to speak?
I actually like them a lot for multiple reasons. Because first of all, I think anytime you can take something and all of the Elseworlds from DC and the What Ifs, the actual What If was a series, as you remember, it would come out as a monthly, like What If This? And I just, it wasn't like hacks doing that. It was always somebody who understood the universe, who got their teeth into that. Yeah. And so I've always found those to be really fascinating, because what they do is they invite new readers in, because you don't have to know anything necessarily. Yeah. This is a standalone universe. Gotham by Gaslight, for example. My favorite What If from Marvel was What If, was it Morbius turned the entire Marvel universe into vampires? And the only, do you remember that one? And the only one who survives is Frank. So I loved that Frank Castle is the last stand against, like, the non-superhero is the one who survives. And I just thought, of course he would, you know, that way, because he's so relentless. And so I've always loved those. So I've been a fan because of that. And the other reason is I am a grouch lately. It's gotten worse in the last couple of years, I would say. And maybe having the COVID break from comics actually made it worse. But the way that everything has to be a crossover now, and there isn't just a Bat continuity or a Wonder Woman continuity or a Green Lantern continuity. It's like a huge ordeal. Every 6 months, there's a whole crossover event that changes the face of the DC universe. So that's exhausting. So I think reading, and because I don't read every DC book, and they're trying to force me into it, and then I'm lost sometimes. And that's, and it's like, please see, you know, this book, Legion of Superheroes 12. Well, I don't read Legion of Superheroes. So I have, like, I'm not going to go buy that just to know what's going on here. Yeah. So it's like, you lose me. So I know it's a money maker, but so for me, the reason Elseworlds and this book, and you know, they stand alone. They get, if you know enough of the universe, you're like, oh, that's clever. But if you don't know, that's also okay. Like, if somebody had never read a Marvel comic, 1602 totally stands on its own. But for you and I, who've read plenty, and you know, we are like, oh, how cool that Captain America is a Native American. That's so cool. Yeah. You know, so there's like really, so I just think that's why I like it so.
Yeah, I think so. I'm always been a big fan of Elseworlds stories. I just like it when they mix it up a bit and give you something that you haven't seen before or you weren't expecting. I mean, don't get me wrong. I still read most stuff that DC puts out, at least on a sort of weekly basis, due to sort of the access we have through the writing we do. And I still enjoy. I don't read every title. God forbid. No, I ain't got the time or the inclination to do so, but I mean, like you said, it's great when you can pick up an Elseworlds book or a What If book, and it doesn't require any prior reading. All it requires is fundamentally a basic knowledge, I think, of the characters, and that'll do you, because it takes you where you've never been before. So I always really been a big fan of them, you know, like you said, Gotham by Gaslight, stuff like that.
Oh, that's just perfect.
Red Sun again. Oh, brilliant. Kingdom Come, I suppose, could be loosely termed an Elseworlds story, or is it just a future story? I'm not too sure. I mean, they're all great. The Nail, that's not bad either, so there's plenty of great stuff in there. So I mean, this one, the way that I was doing a bit of research for this episode and sort of read sort of where Neil Gaiman was coming from when he sort of got the genesis of the idea, and it's quite interesting that he was sort of approached by Marvel to obviously come up with something and was sort of given a carte blanche to come up with his own story. It's not like he was jumping on to start writing, you know, Spider-Man or Iron Man and just picking up the continuity. It was, you know, something of his own creation. And then 9/11 happened, which sort of massively affected his thinking, that he didn't want to then go to set the story in New York, which as most people know, seems to be the epicenter of the Marvel Universe, and most right. stories take place in New York City, don't they? So he wanted to stay well away from New York. He didn't want planes, skyscrapers, bombs, or guns in his story. He didn't want a lot of action or violence. He completely wanted to take it away from there. And then apparently, not long after 9/11, and that was affecting his thinking, he was in Venice, I believe, on like a vacation, or, you know, a sightseeing trip or something like that. And that sort of old world architecture and structures that you see in, I mean, I've never been to Venice, but, you know, I've seen plenty of films that take place in Venice.
Sure, yeah.
And that sort of inspired him to go back to this time period, this Elizabethan time period. So it's, but for the tragedy of 9/11, this story could have been very different. You know, that's a what if story in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And I think it was smart of him to do, because we didn't need more of that. It's like right now, as we're recording this, still in the middle of the pandemic, there's a lot of books and movies that are now coming out that are about it. And I feel like that's a mistake. As somebody who reads a lot, and, you know, and we both watch a lot of movies and we read a lot of comics, and I don't want to see COVID in my comics. Like, I don't want Gotham to be affected by the pandemic, because I just want to read a story. Like, I don't need Bloodhaven to be like, you know, Dick's mask changed to stop COVID. The world sucks. So, like, I need to get in here and escape. So, I think that was really smart of him to say, okay, let's get as far away from it as possible, because people need it. And even though this didn't come out until 2003, it's not as though the effects of 9/11 have worn off for all of us who were there, you know, not in New York, but there, air quotes, there living it. So I think it was such a smart move. And I think all of these publishers and filmmakers who are like rushing to put out COVID movies and to put out COVID books, I think they're making a mistake, because I don't think people want that. I think people want something like this. So, like, take me away into a really interesting, well-researched, well-developed other place that I can forget about this for an hour while I'm reading this.
Yeah, people want escapism in times of trouble, don't they, really? They want to take their minds away from it. I know I do. I can see where he was coming from. So it's quite an interesting concept that he basically decided to almost retell the genesis of the golden age of Marvel in this time period. So by doing that and concentrating on the golden age, it meant that other really popular characters at the time, well, still popular characters, but characters like Wolverine, Frank Castle, Luke Cage, people like that, were not going to be part of this book, because he wanted to just set it in that sort of 60s era of Marvel and those characters that came up out of that era, rather than ones that came in the 70s and after that. So it was, you know, like the original X-Men lineup is in this book of, you know, in a different guise, rather than maybe the more illustrious ones like Wolverine and Storm and Nightcrawler and things like that. So looking back at his own childhood, I suppose, because I think I'd read that, you know, his sort of first, because he was a child himself during the Golden Age, I think he was born in the late 50s, so he was living that life period. So he was, in effect, reliving his own childhood with this book and playing with those characters. And, you know, it must have been quite a thrill for him to do, as well as a massive undertaking.
Yeah. Well, I think what is interesting too, because for you guys, you didn't get Marvel Comics like I got. So like in the 60s, Marvel Comics was just like at the grocery store or wherever. But you guys had to get them in reprints. So for him, he was getting like kind of the best of the best too. He was getting reprints of like heavy hitting big storylines too. He wasn't going to get like, you know, janky throwaway backstory from Thor. So he was only going to get whatever the best Thor story was that was going to be reprinted in the comics he was reading.
Yeah.
So I think that's totally true so he was really living in the greatest hits world. And so his whole view of the Marvel Universe was everything is always amazing. Like every story is good. And you know, that was so he's talking Stan Lee, Ditko, and Kirby. Those are the big three. So he's reading stuff like that. Oh, yeah. I mean, your whole world would change. You know, you and I have read that stuff, but we've read that stuff, you know, after having, like, the first comic I read wasn't by Stan Lee and, you know, Ditko.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, but to go back and look at that stuff, we come at it with a different lens. But to be an 8-year-old and to pick up a Ditko comic or a Jack Kirby comic for the first time, and that's the first comic you've seen, the first superhero comic, I mean, that would be And this is like a love letter to them in a real way.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And I think that's what's really clever about it. Although he puts the whole situation in this completely sort of foreign environment, foreign time period, the characters do feel somewhat consistent with their original visions, don't they? It doesn't feel like...
Especially Matt. I think Matt Murdock is almost like the regular... It's just Matt Murdock. Yeah. Like there's... Other than the fact he's... And, you know, you can almost hear his Irish accent in this. But other than that, he is... Of all of the characters, he's the one that I thought he nailed perfectly. I don't know if you felt that way. But I like, man, this is just Matt Murdock you lifted straight from, the, you know, whatever... book you read the day before.
Yeah. Oh, I think most of them are. Peter Parker or Peter Parquois, however you however you want to pronounce it. Yeah, they just feel very faithful to it literally is just like he's picked up that character out of the 1960s and plonked it 400 years in the past, but not obviously changed the way the character operates and interacts with people, but changed nothing about that character's personality, have they? Elseworld stories sometimes.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes it so perfect is, and I think people who who read this book in 2003, 2004, or especially people are going to hear our show and then go pick it up now, they're going to be shocked to learn that Natasha isn't a hero. Mm. But we, who've read comics for a long time, know that she's not always been a hero. But in the movie version of Black Widow, everybody sees her as this Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. Yeah. She, when I first met Black Widow, she was a villain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I love that he was held true to that.
Yeah. Oh, it's fine. I've got no problem with that. I mean, like you said, she's been a villain many times. In the Ultimate Marvel Universe, she was a villain in that, a despicable villain. So it wouldn't be the first time or hopefully the last time. And it kind of fits with that character, that duplicitous kind of nature of the character being a spy and maybe a double agent, things like that. So it doesn't bother me at all. I think the only one of probably the characters in there that perhaps didn't quite sit right was they made Bruce Banner, or David Banner as they call him in this particular book, a bit like the TV show. They made him more of a villainous character, although I suppose he does have that redemption at the end where he saves Peter from the sort of fallout blast, which inadvertently makes him become this universe's version of Hulk. So I suppose there's a redemption out there at the end, but other than that, before that, he's working for the villains of the piece. So I wasn't too keen on that because Banner's generally speaking a noble character, but
as Banner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah,
that's the worst part. It's like I agree with you totally because you would believe if somehow Hulk was being mind controlled or manipulated. But the fact that it's Banner, right? You're like, wait, no. I'm with you. I didn't get that. Yeah. But I understand why, you know, he wanted Bruce in there somewhere. So he had to, there wasn't really another place for him, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. He's quite a peripheral character in a lot of ways, isn't he? He doesn't really do a lot until the very end. And then it gives you his origin story in the final panels of the book. But one thing I do notice about this, and it ties into what I was saying about his sort of post 9/11 reaction, is that this book, this weighty book, there's very, for a Marvel book as well, there's very little, next to none in fact, actual fighting in there, is there? Very little action. It's a very cerebral, kind of Machiavellian plotting kind of book, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is.
Well, I feel like it was reminiscent of what it was. So like a plotting British novel is what it is, right? There's a lot of that. And I love a good plotting British novel. I'm all for that. Like, give me a dense story that is intriguing. You could argue, there's just a lot of standing around. There's a lot of people on boats and a lot of people standing in dark rooms talking and a lot of Von Doom shouting at the sky. And there's a lot of that. You're right. But I think because the story is so, it is an intrigue story and there is spycraft and there's, he creates a lot of tension, that it worked.
Yeah. No, it doesn't, you don't read it and go, oh, I wish there was a punch up coming up or something like
that's
that.
Totally true. Yeah.
You know, I wish there was some superhero, you know, SmackDown on the next page, which normally you would get plenty of in a Marvel novel or a DC novel or any kind of superhero novel. But it doesn't, you don't miss it. You're more intrigued by what's going on and the plot and the fact that obviously you're still trying to figure out what's going on. And sometimes he's not so explicit with who the character is. I mean, sometimes you'll meet a character and they'll go, oh, that's that blind minstrel, Matthew Murdock. So immediately you right. go, ah, this is Daredevil. But then other characters, they're not quite as explicit with the names or who they are. And perhaps you're sort of having to sort of wait and see, has that character revealed themselves a bit more as to which Marvel hero or Marvel villain, I should say, it truly is. So I don't miss any action or lack of action. I think if anything, if there was a, you know, huge splash pages of all this, you know, glorious superhero battle, I think it would be somewhat out of place, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I agree so. And I think because I agree, he creates tension instead of relying on mindless action. And there's and again, we talked about Canon Films. We both like mindless action. You know, there's something to that, but that isn't what a Neil Gaiman, there's never been a Neil Gaiman story that had that. And so I appreciate Marvel getting out of his way. And I don't know who the editor was. Was it Quesada at this time?
I think it was Joe Quesada, because I think it was Quesada who invited him to editor-in-chief at this time was Joe Quesada, yeah.
Okay, so I appreciate him you don't ask Neil Gaiman to come along if you're not going to get out of his way.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that he did that. And of course, having Andy Kubert be the artist also helps, because again, it's somebody who Marvel trusts. I think what they did is they said, well, Neil Gaiman is a storyteller. Let him tell his story. And if we felt, I'm assuming if they were like, well, this is boring, we got to spice it up. They would have done that, but it's never boring. It never wavers. There's never, even like I said, there's a lot of panels where they're like, let's stand around on this boat. Now let's stand in this room.
Yeah.
At no point though, where you're like, move along. You're like, oh, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And I don't know, do you think that's Kubert who makes us like sit at the edge of our seat, or is that just the story that Neil has written that makes that work?
I think it's probably a bit of both, to be honest with you. You know, I always say you writing and art have to go hand in hand. You know, if one's lacking, the book for me falls flat. You know, I've said it a million times, you know, great writing with shitty art or great art with shitty writing, I'm not interested. I need both to be good. So I think it's a combination of the two. I mean, the plot, the slow burning nature of it, the way they sort of it unfolds at a very slow, deliberate pace, coupled with, you know, we'll get to the art later on, but the wonderful renderings of these Elizabethan versions of our favorite heroes, it just is a beautiful concoction, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I have to say, I think it was an interesting choice too. And it's like such a Neil Gaiman thing to do that one of the Marvel characters I know least about is Doctor Strange, to be fair. I was never a big Doctor Strange reader. So his wife in this, Clea, who's his partner in the comic as well.
Yeah.
She, I know so little about, but I just appreciated that Neil put him as the focal point, like as one of, like he and Nick Fury are kind of the instigators of all the action that happens. And that made a lot of sense to me for a book, like you said, that is going to be lacking in a lot of action, but where it's plot heavy and we're going to have lots going on. It makes sense to have the two kind of like the doctor, you know, kind of mysticist and this strategist, Nick Fury, be the ones leading the charge, because it wouldn't make sense to have Wolverine just go in a berserker rage here.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it was an interesting choice. And I don't know, what do you know? Like, what is your relationship with Doctor Strange? Because I'll be frank, like I know who he is. I know who Clea is. I know enough to get three questions right on Jeopardy maybe, but that's about all.
probably much the same if I'm being brutally honest. You know, I don't want to bluff my way through it. I don't have a lot of Doctor Strange standalone books on the shelf, that's for sure. You know, I tend to sort of read him when he crops up in an ensemble book or a crossover event book.
Yeah, he was in The Defenders.
Exactly, yeah, with Hulk and Hulk and Namor, was it the original lineup, something like that?
I think that's right.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I'm not a big fan of the magic and mysticism side of comics, really. I prefer a bit more of a, you know, street. You know, that's probably why I'm such a big Batman fan. You know, I prefer that kind of street level realistic. I'm not the world's biggest fan of either outer space stuff or mystical arts kind of stuff. But, you know, I appreciate the character, that's for sure. But like you said, it's good to have him and Nick Fury, or Sir Nicholas Fury, to give him his title in his book. Yeah, to have them front and centre as your two main drivers of the plot, because they're two of the sort of, when you look at who's in this book, it's everyone, isn't it? It's a who's who, you know, Spider-Man, Hulk, Daredevil, the Fantastic Four, the X-Men, Doctor Doom, they're all there. So to have Strange and Fury as the two main drivers, I think it's good. It's refreshing that it gives them their time in the spotlight rather than, you know, them sort of being peripheral figures or just, you know, dipping in and out. I like that. I think it's a good choice, personally speaking.
I agree. And I think it made me, rereading this, because it's, again, it's been years since I've read it, made me think, well, am I missing something about Doctor Strange that Neil is getting, or is it because it's Doctor Strange in Neil's hands that I'm really digging it? Like, I can't tell, you know, but I really, it does make me want to go back and maybe take a peek at some of those 1960s Doctor Stranges to see what I missed. Because, you know, like I said, if he showed up in something, I wasn't like, oh, I don't want to read this because Doctor Strange is here. But he just was never, he was just never my guy in the Marvel Universe. And so, you know, I guess rereading this gave me a whole new appreciation for him, with his kind of, you know, playing three-dimensional chess. I just thought it was really good. And I feel like maybe he's the avatar for Neil. Like, Neil's our wizard a little, you know, and so he needs a wizard to get us through it. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. But it's a good choice. It really is.
Yeah.
And what I really do like about this book is the way it integrates real. It's not just all your Marvel characters. This integrates real people into the story and real British and American history, doesn't it? You know, it's the sort of the dying embers of the Elizabethan era through to after her demise, King James VI taking the throne. And then you have the sort of journey to the new world, the United States of America, and the Virginia Dare character,
who's a real character.
She was the first English child born in the New World, in the colonized, you know, British colony over there. Roanoke, am I pronouncing that right? Or is it
Roanoke is how we say it. But
Roanoke colony. Yeah. So she was a real historical figure, wasn't she? That he's managed to repurpose for this story. I mean, obviously, you know, they've taken a poetic license by giving her superpowers and what have you, and making her this sort of turn into like a griffin or whatever it was she turns into. It's obviously, well, who knows, maybe the real Virginia Dare did, who knows.
But
it's great, isn't it, the way he's able to give you there's all your Golden Age Marvel characters, and this is their sort of a retelling of their emergence, but he puts it alongside real historical events, real historical people. But it doesn't seem jarring, doesn't it? It doesn't seem out of place, does it? It flows nicely, and you don't ever read it, and think, well, this is just stupid, really. How can Queen Elizabeth be interacting with the Marvel Universe? But it kind of works, doesn't it?
Oh, I think it works perfectly, again, because Nick Fury is a human.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that, and he's Sir Nicholas Fury, as you say, and he's like the head of her MI6, right? And that's who he is. He's the head of security and head of intelligence. So that makes perfect sense. And at no point does it ever feel weird. I think good historical fiction can do that. And I like historical fiction. I like where you can take an event, and this is, I don't know if you've ever read the book, or the movie isn't very good, but the book, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter.
I've seen the film, but I must confess I've not read the book.
The film tried to make it a vampire movie, which was fine. And if I just had watched the movie, I probably would have enjoyed the shit out of it. But because the book is truly a work of historical fiction, like all of the events in the book are real things that happened to Abraham Lincoln. It's just they use vampirism to explain his mother's death instead of a blood disease, which is true. She had a blood disease in real life. So I feel like good historical fiction, you can throw fantasy in there. Sometimes historical fiction just has, you know, it's like, you know, we're just reading the history of World War II with a fake character, but everybody else is real. That's fine. But I just think this is such a cool way to broach the subject and to learn things about, like, you know, how many Americans know that after who took over after Elizabeth died. Most Americans wouldn't know. And so, like you said, to place it in reality was super cool. And it felt really grounded. And, you know, people believe in weird shit still today, right? I mean, like you said, Virginia Dare isn't a griffin as far as we know. But yeah. Somebody probably believed that. I'm sure Neil found some snippet somewhere where people were like, well, Virginia Dare just disappeared, which is what we know happened. So I'm sure there's like, oh, she flew away. I saw her do it. You know, so you're like, oh,
yeah.
People still to this day believe all kinds of stuff. People believe in dragons and people believe in whatever. So I feel like it just, 1602, we didn't know anything. Science was, oh, you've got a fever. We're going to put leeches on your neck.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so yeah, it's just, it's so good. It is. At no point was I ever taken out of it by seeing the real characters. Yeah. I thought it was great.
No, I completely agree. And again, what transpires with the genius of Gaiman's writing is he uses those historical figures, well, firstly, to help drive the plot, but he doesn't drastically reimagine those historical figures, and he makes them consistent with at least how history perceives them to be, you know, how they were documented. Because, I mean, James VI, who obviously takes the throne after Elizabeth died, he had like a firm belief in the divine right of kings and his loathing of the what they call the witch breed in this film, which breed is the book's version of mutants, mirrors the real life King James's view of Catholics and the way they were treated. And, you know, conspiring with the Grand Inquisitor to eliminate the witch breed. Obviously, we find out that the Grand Inquisitor is actually Eric Lane Chireke Magneto, who's trying to save the witch breed sort of surreptitiously. But, you know, it's consistent with that King James VI. You know, it's not a silly reimagining of it. He takes real historical elements of the characters and services the story he wants to tell. So it's really just genius writing. How he managed to come up with this, and how long it must have taken him to sort of flesh out the story from that central point and bring in all the different Marvel characters. I can't even fathom how a mind like that would work, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you acknowledge, so he came up with the idea in what, late 2001 or late 2002, and it didn't come out until end of 2003. So yeah. He obviously, you know, spent his time and did his research, and it is really smart. And I actually, I have a former student of mine who's a friend of mine now. He's a history teacher, and he's going to use this in his ninth grade history class. He's going to have them read 1602.
That's so cool.
it is. And I feel like it's going to really get the kids, because I mean, you imagine if you were 13, 14, your teacher walked in and plopped this down, and this is your history textbook. And then just imagine the assignments that you could do where you're like, okay, find the real historical things. Who are these other characters? Like Reed Richards isn't real, but is there a Reed Richards-esque type scientist that existed in Elizabethan England? Is there some sort of mystic who could have been Dr. Strange? You know, so
yeah.
you can turn it into all kinds of fun assignments, and then they're going to learn real history because they're reading this. And it is just a testament, as you said, to Gaiman's writing, but to that research. And he obviously spent over a year working on it before anybody saw issue one. So it's just amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's true though, because like you were just saying about, is there like a character like Reed Richards in Elizabethan times? Dr. Strange and Nick Fury, who we mentioned were the sort of two sort of leading lights of this book, they do mirror real people who were around at that time. There was a guy called John Dee who was around at the same time as Queen Elizabeth, who was like a sort of a mathematician, astrologer kind of guy, but it was also apparently very interested in conjuring and the sort of the mystical arts. So although it's Doctor Strange, it ain't John Dee, it's Doctor Strange in this book, you know, it kind of services that same thing. And even
that's
Nick Fury. Yeah. And even Nick Fury at that time, there was a, I'm not a history expert. I'm not sort of pulling this out of the depths of my knowledge. I did a bit of reading before we recording, but there was a guy called in 1602 called Sir Francis Walsingham, who apparently was one of the great spy masters of the time, who obtained the evidence that led to the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots, and had vital information he acquired that helped defeat the Spanish Armada as well. So again, he's, what he does so well there, Gaiman, is he uses, again, real people from history, changes them to make them Marvel characters. So instead of Sir Walsingham, it's Nick Fury. Instead of John Dee, it's Doctor Strange. So again, the genius level involved, and that, like you said, the level of intricacy and research, it's not your average superhero book, is it, by any stretch of the imagination?
No, that's amazing. I didn't know that. Those, again, you know, American history. I'm a little better, obviously. That's amazing. That's so cool. That again makes me just love it even more. That's real. And of course, obviously, he knew that. And it just it adds even more credence to what Tyler is going to do with his students, because they'll be able to discover that stuff and be blown away, too. And you know, and stuff like that. Now that you've told me that, well, now I'm going to never forget that. You know, instead of it being like, again, instead of it just being an answer on Jeopardy or something, it's something that I've now connected to this, and so I'm going to you know, do that digging and do some more of that research, because I'm sure. And they did spin-offs of this too. So that Neil wrote, but they did, you know, other, like Peter finally becomes Spider-Man and Hulk's out. So I've not read those actually, but rereading this makes me want to go read those. Did you read them?
No, I haven't. No, I'm aware of them, but no, I haven't. Yeah, like you said, there's Spider-Man. I think there's a Fantastic Four one as well, which sort of covers them on the journey to, I think, in London or something like that. So yeah, although they're not Gaiman writing them, I would imagine they're pretty sort of worthy sequels, and you know, I do want to read more of these characters or these versions of the characters. So yeah, I would definitely try and seek them out somehow and try and give them a go, for sure. Definitely. Yeah. That what I just mentioned about those two historical figures, that's probably the tip of the proverbial iceberg. I mean, knowing the kind of writing that he does, I would imagine that maybe every single Marvel character in this can be tied somewhat loosely to a real historical figure. I don't know. I'd have to do some further reading, but I wouldn't surprise me. Would it surprise you? I can't imagine so.
No, it wouldn't surprise me to find out that a Grand Inquisitor had secret children.
Yeah.
We know that stuff like that, you know, that people who were, air quotes, religious paragons often did all kinds of things that they, you know, that they shamed. It still happens. I don't know how much you follow American news. I hopefully none, because we're awful. But there's this guy, Jerry Falwell Jr., who's a giant religious right-wing extremist guy, and he runs a university called Liberty University. And it's like, they're really big dicks about like even doing more than holding hands on campus and like really shame people for anything that's considered out of the norm sexually. And then you come to find out for these past 10 years, he and his wife have been in this relationship with the pool boy, where his wife would have sex with the pool boy and he would watch. And again, if that's what you're into, dude, be into that, because you're all adults. However, don't then, out of the other side of your mouth, condemn anyone for doing anything that's a little, you know, kinky. So it wouldn't surprise me that the Grand Inquisitor would have a set of twins that he kept close to him, but didn't acknowledge to them that they were, you know, his own children. And so I'm sure that has happened on more than one occasion, without a doubt. So I loved that's what he did with Magneto, making him the Grand Inquisitor, and then having Peter and Wanda there.
Yeah.
I thought that was just, that was such a smart move. I loved it.
It is, yeah. And speaking of that, actually, the witch breed thing, which obviously is an allegory for mutants and obviously the X-Men, that the way in which they're sort of persecuted and executed in some ways in this book, it ties into the modern day version of the X-Men and the way, in fact, a book you and I talked about a few episodes ago of this show, where we did God Loves, Man Kills, the X-Men book.
Yeah.
In that particular book, the mutants are being hunted and executed because of who they are. And the same thing was going on back in 1602. So it's kind of strange. I guess the more things change, the more they stay the same, really. But, you know, there's a lot of parallels there, isn't there? Maybe Stan Lee, when he, you know, created that idea for the X-Men in the 60s, maybe he had one eye on that himself. I don't know. But it definitely mirrors modern life, doesn't it?
It does. And I think, well, it's just, it happens, right? If you're different, if you are special in any way, one of two things happen. You either are revered or you're vilified. And I think that's what the, you know, for the mutants, that's the way it is. And in this book, in this, Magneto is actually, when we first meet him, he's trying to kill Warren. He's trying to kill Angel.
Yeah.
And because he's a mutant who can't pass, air quotes, pass, which again, there's that whole idea of, can you pass? And in America, you know, if you were a slave, but you, you know, a lot of people were, they say, oh, well, you're passing for white. And that was the term that was used. And it's like a terrible, awful thing, you know, for people of mixed race, they could pass off as white and it would help them get away from their captors. And I thought Magneto doing that, right? He's like, well, I'm going to kill Warren because he can't pass as human. But if he had captured Scott or if he had captured Bobby, he would have let him go. He would have faked his death and let him go because he could then be reintegrated into humanity and pass off as a human. Yeah. So I thought that was a really, again, like you said, the historical context of doing that to people and you know, like I said, I mean, that's unfortunately, it's still how it is. You're, if you're famous, you're a hero, or if you're famous, you're a villain. It's, there's not just a lot of people who are famous and are just like folks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's an interesting sort of commentary on the world and things never change, I guess, you know.
Don't you wish they would though? I mean, that's the tragedy of this is right. Neil is writing this in the mid 2000s, making it take place in the 1600s, and Stan's writing it in the 1960s, having it take place in the 1960s. But in that 40 years from when Stan wrote it to when Neil wrote it, nothing changed. And then his also, right, Neil, like you're saying, Neil's commentary is 400 years have passed, not just 40, and still, this is what we do to people who are different.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. We haven't not become, you know, we're supposed to be a more enlightened sort of species, but maybe we're not, you know. Maybe we're still as blinkered as we always once were. Okay, well, I want to speak about a little bit about the writing in this then. Obviously, we've spoken about the way it's constructed, but the actual writing in terms of the dialogue, I think it's the sort of tone and cadence to the way people speak. It does feel very authentic to the time period, doesn't it? Without being, you know, everyone saying ye and forsooth and prithee and, you know, the kind of Shakespearean tropes that you kind of find. It feels accessible, but it does have that kind of old English kind of vibe to it, doesn't it? I think it's very, very cleverly written in that respect, isn't it? You don't have to be, you know, a well-read person to necessarily dive into it and still be able to understand what's going on, yet they still retain some of that old English dialect in there.
Yeah, I think that was really smart of him, because right, he could have said, well, this is an Elizabethan book, I'm gonna write it in Elizabethan English, which is Shakespearean English, and it was smart of him not to. Honestly, I would love a version of this where that is, like, I would like an Elseworlds of 1602 where Neil did write it all in Elizabethan Shakespearean English. That would just tickle my funny bone. I would love that. But I don't think, I think that would have made it, like you said, 100% inaccessible. So yeah, he found a way to have everybody talk in a way that was clearly not 2003 England or 2003 America.
But
again, it just shows to his mad skill set. And Sandman, you know, he does that in Sandman, right? Because Sandman traverses time and space and country, and he always manages to capture the right sound of wherever the characters are. Yeah, it's just a skill that I wish I had.
Don't we all? That's for sure. but yeah, it's good, isn't it? It feels contemporary enough to not alienate anybody. But yet there is that, you know, you just look flicking through the pages now, there's kind of, they do speak in that sort of more, dare I say, more eloquent tone that was generally employed back then as opposed to
except
now.
For Matt, because Matt Matt's Irish and he is like a street rat minstrel. And so he captures that even more. And even with Natasha, because she's speaking English through Russian. So he really finds a way that even, like, you can tell who the people are. Like I said, you can almost hear them.
Yeah.
And you keep accidentally referring to it as a film, but it feels that way, right? It's so, and not only is it cinematic, but I think what you're talking about, and I didn't even think about this when I was reading, but you're so right, is the lyrics, you know, I'm saying that, the dialogue, it's so specific to each person.
Yeah.
And the letterer, I think it's Todd Klein, who is still lettering today, when he letters Thor, like the way that he does Thor's word bubbles, are so cool. And you're like, so you know it's him, and he changes. When Thor is Thor, he's different than when he's Don Blake. You know, he sounds different. It's just, it is a masterclass, without a doubt.
No, it is for sure. He really does capture each character's sort of voice beautifully, I think. And
what did you make of the way that he has Captain America when he's in his Native American guise? I even thought that was like spot on. I thought that was such a smart dodge there. Yeah. What did you? That's my big question for you. As I reread it, the Captain America part of it, and the way that not only was he constructed as a character, but as a plot device.
I was going to bring that up.
Sorry, I didn't mean to jump to Sark.
I'm very glad you did, actually, you know, because it links quite nicely. Yeah, like you were saying, so Captain America in this is portrayed as a Native American, indigenous American character called Rojas or Rojas, however you want to pronounce it.
Yeah, close enough to Rogers.
So you can, I mean, hindsight's a great thing because, you know, I can't remember how it was when I read it for the first time. But there's enough there that you can see it's kind of a version of Steve Rogers. So it's, you know, you don't have to sort of...
He throws that shield.
Exactly. So you can see that it's a version of Steve Rogers in this story. But then we learn, again, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't read this book, but hopefully you will have if you listen to the show. We learn that this is the Steve Rogers from the actual modern day continuity. Well, actually, no, not from the modern day continuity, but from like a version of the modern day where he was sort of the last man standing in the sort of fight against an evil dictator president, which I think you're supposed to believe is the purple man, looking at the pictures. Kilgrave, who we saw in David Tennant playing in the Jessica Jones Netflix show most recently. And he's sort of the sort of last hero standing, and they want to not only kill him, but sort of destroy him. So not even, and I think there's a quote in there saying, not even my ashes would remain to sort of inspire any further uprising against this sort of dictator. But in doing that, they accidentally send him back. Or is it accidentally? It's never explained whether they meant to do it. Send him back 400 years to obviously this time period where he sort of awakes in sort of pre-British occupation America and doesn't really know who he is and ends up getting sort of taken in by a Native American tribe, and then the rest is history. And then you learn that at the sort of literal sort of, I think the last installment of this book, issue 8, I think is when he explains all that to Virginia. Me personally, I'm not, as much as I love this book and I think it's nigh on perfect, as we've already sort of discussed to this point, I think this is probably my only part of it that I'm not 100% on board. And I think it kind of works, but doesn't work. It kind of, in a way, almost takes me out of the story, that you go, oh, by the way, this is the actual Captain America from, you know, as you know and love him, he's just accidentally been sent back through time, and kind of his arrival in this time was the catalyst for all the other Marvel sort of heroes and villains starting to appear in this time, and it's caused this huge rift in the space-time continuum, which is what's causing all this chaos, and the world's maybe going to end as a result. It kind of feels like a bit of a 180 from where the book's been going up to that point. What do you think?
That was it. So it's that and The Watcher, right? Those two things are the parts that take me out of it. And that's why it was, I wanted to, and I didn't mean to change this. I just didn't want to forget. And I was like, okay,
we were going to get there.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. So I agree 100% with everything that you said. And honestly, at first, I convinced myself, and now you've convinced me the other way with you thinking that it's Kilgrave, which I didn't think about that. Now that I see that, I'm like, you're right, that's who it is. I see it as, this was just me trying to like fill it in so that it didn't bug me as much. So I'll just tell you my theory, and then, but yours is better. So now mine's nonsense. But is that what Neil was doing? Because Captain America was not invented by Marvel.
Yeah.
Captain America existed pre-Marvel.
Yeah.
It was a character they picked up and reimagined.
Yeah.
So the way I looked at it as, because in this version, Steve Rogers is the interloper, and he is the cat, as you said, he's the catalyst for this 1602 version. Mm-hmm. So he's been literally taken out of time, and he's placed in this other time, and now he's starting the Marvel Universe, right? So I thought that was his nod to what really happened, is that this 1940s version of Steve Rogers, 30s and 40s, like Nazi punching Captain America, was taken out of, I can't even remember the publisher that he was for, and moved into Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
Then, and he used the catalyst for Marvel Comics to exist. So I thought that's what was happening, and that what Neil was saying was that he wasn't the Marvel Captain America, he was the pre-Marvel Captain America. But now that you say all that, I realize there were a few things he said at the end when he's talking to Nick, and he's like, I remember a version of you, that totally shifts on my theory. So, damn it. I was trying to, I came up with that because I was trying to make it okay, to make it not be the weak link of this story.
Yeah.
But now that I'm listening to you and saying that's Kilgrave and then remembering that, yeah, I think it just, I don't know. I kind of wish it weren't the case.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I guess it could be a sort of a allegory for what you say. I mean, there's no, that's the beauty of books and of art. There is no right or wrong way of looking at it. You take it how you want to take it, and you come up with the own conclusion that you make. And it doesn't matter what someone else thinks, you know, I suppose, unless you're hearing it direct from the creator's mouth, as in, this is what it is, and because I created it and I wrote it, if I say that's what it is, if I say that's what it is, then that's what it is. But to the best of my knowledge, well, maybe there is some interview out there where he expands on that, but no, I think it, you know, I think what you're saying kind of works as well, because he's that precursor, isn't he? And then here he's the precursor as well, so it kind of works both ways, I think. It just kind of takes you out of the story a little bit, doesn't it? Where all of a sudden, after, you know, 7 issues of this wonderful, involved, elaborate story from 1602, all of a sudden you get panels set in the modern day, and it, you know, where he explains why he's there, and it just seems a little incongruous out of the story, and then, you know, again, spoiler alert, where he kind of, it ends with him going back to where he came from, and that repairs the rift, and the kind of the 1602 Marvel Universe kind of endures in like this kind of created pocket universe or whatever.
Pocket universe around a watcher's neck. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's, you think, well, why, you know, if he was there and it all started because of him, but then he leaves. So, but then, like you said, is that them saying, well, that's kind of Steve Rogers in effect going into the ice again and being removed from it, and then I don't know. Do you know what I mean? It's hard to say.
I do.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Right, because on its surface, like, what I loved about it when you first meet him and they're like, wait, why is your Native American bodyguard white and blonde? Yeah. And Virginia says, well, it turns out, you idiots, that you weren't the first white people here, that there were, you know, the Icelandic folks and the Vikings were here, which is true. We know historically that is a fact.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh man, that's so clever. And of course, you know, that's Captain America because he's a Native American. And for me, I loved, and again, he's Neil Gaiman. He could do whatever he wants. So who am I, a mere mortal, to question his greatness? But I loved it so much. Like you said, you're totally engrossed. And I was like, to me, that was the most clever thing, is that Steve Rogers is a Native American.
Mm.
And I didn't need another explanation. I guess I didn't need the Watcher. I didn't need that. Mm. I was just content with this existing in a pocket universe.
Yeah.
But then, because it's set up as an Elseworlds, as a what if, but then what it happens is this is real. Like, by throwing the Watcher in there and having it be our Steve Rogers, you're saying this is really actually part of the Marvel Universe now. And it just felt, again, like trying to cram too much in there. And so it was disappointing, not enough to hate it, not enough for me to say, let's not do it. But it's just a bit of a kick in the teeth. And I guess that is a testament to how good it is and how invested we were that we could be disappointed. Because if it was crappy, we wouldn't care.
Yeah. No, I suppose, you know, it works fine for the purpose of the story, but it just, for me, it just, it, like I said, it just takes me out a little bit and just seems a little bit out of the, because the whole book seems kind of really grounded in reality. Like we said earlier, and when we were talking earlier, we said about how he links it to real history and real historical figures. So it, although obviously it's a high concept story of people with powers and what have you, it feels grounded and real. And then at the end you find out, well, there's this guy from 400 years in the future who was sent back. And, you know, it just kind of, I don't know, just slight, I'm nitpicking because it's probably the only thing I would say about this book that I don't like, or that I don't think is nigh on perfect. So I suppose it's just me. Maybe I'm finding a fault for the sake of it. I don't know. But
I'm with you. That's why I asked, because I felt the same way. I'm like, it wasn't enough for me to dislike it or for me to say, oh, man, when Max said, let's start the show back up, I'm like, oh, my God, let's do this one. You know, it wasn't going to take me out of that. But it's definitely just, I don't know. I guess I just felt, again, he has such a high standard. And there's very few times where I've been disappointed by Neil ever. So it's again, you know, I'm not mad and I'm really not disappointed. It's just, it's that thing that we fans do where we wish something and then we get mad, you know, and because you and I are reasonable people, when we're not part of toxic fandoms, we're not like burning the world down because it didn't end the way we liked it.
Yeah.
It's Neil's story and he got to tell it. And I appreciate that. I just wished for something else. I thought it would be something else. And I guess that's the twist, right? He set us up.
Yeah.
We could pull the rug out from under us.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, but I suppose it's kind of good because it, like we're saying about how Cap births the universe, the book ends with literal birthing of your characters as you know and love them, doesn't it? I mean, that last page, you finally see the Hulk. You finally see.
I know, that was awesome.
And then I think the literal second to last panel is Peter Parker being bitten by the spider.
Yeah,
and then we all know. We all know what goes after that. So. It's, you know, you literally get Rogers going and then the two of your most, probably the two most famous Marvel superheroes in terms of general audience are then placed out there. So I suppose it kind of works on that level, and you get obviously.
Yeah. And that is that what you just said is I didn't think about that until what you just said. The two most famous Marvel superheroes took a back seat.
Yeah.
Hulk and Spider-Man aren't in this. That's totally true.
Yeah, exactly. They're in it, but they're pre Spider-Man and pre Hulk, aren't they? They're pre the thing that happens to both of them to give them their powers doesn't happen till the very, very end of the book. So they're just civilians, you know, normal people. So they're in there, but you don't get to see them become or go down the path they're about to go down until the very end. So it's quite cleverly done, actually. It's quite a nice. Maybe I regret everything I just said, actually.
No, I loved it. No, I think you're totally right. That's awesome. I agree. And I think that's, again, back to what we were saying, that he had to stick with, you know, like you said, Wolverine's not in it, Storm's not in it.
Yeah.
They keep hinting that Storm's going to be in it, right? Like, there's these weird storms, and I'm like, Aurora's going to show up. And I know she can't.
Yeah.
I know that she doesn't exist in the 60s, but every time it's like, oh, there's a storm. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah, exactly. You kind of half expect. You kind of expect it to show up, don't you, with kind of witch or something, you know.
Yeah, I know, but she wasn't there.
Yeah,
it was too bad.
Yeah,
but it was again. I think that was a nice touch up because there's something in there about, you know, he's like these Marvels, and so there's lots of like cool, clever, like when you were talking earlier about Neil's actual writing. There's lots of fun wordplay for comic nerds. You're like, oh, I get what you did there.
Yeah.
You know, I see that line there was super clever. So that's why I just kept thinking, they're like, the weather's weird. I'm like, well, duh, because Storm is up there. No, she wasn't. But that was okay. Of course, she couldn't be. And I knew she couldn't be.
Yeah.
But it's like, it was okay.
It's fine. But what he does quite well as well is he's very, although this is a complete reimagine, the origins of how heroes get their powers is quite faithful. Obviously, we've just spoken about Hulk and Spider-Man, but the origin of this for Daredevil is explained in this book, and the Fantastic Four as well. Now, granted, obviously, they don't go into space on a rocket and get hit by cosmic rays, but they're on a boat on the ocean and they get hit by some kind of mysterious gases or something like that. And obviously, Matt Murdock as well encounters some kind of almost radioactive material in a cave, doesn't he? Which gives him those superhuman senses. So he does still give us those versions that we know and love, doesn't he?
Yeah, and I think it's great. And again, Doctor Strange gets called away. It's just Doctor Strange's origins the same.
Yeah.
Right? He gets called away and he's because he's supposed to go, and he's already a doctor, and then he learns to be a mystic. Yeah, and his wife, Clea in the comic, she's a dimension hopper, and she's a dimension it's amazing how faithful. It's stuck, and you know, Natasha is the most dangerous woman in Europe because she is.
Yeah.
It really is. It really is a nice, again, it's like a love letter to Jack and Stan and Steve. And I think, like you said, it would have been so cool to be a fly on the wall and watch the experience of creating this and how much fun he must have had and doing this. And like, you know, is there ever a moment of like, he was like, man, that's clever. That's good. You know, like, oh, I can't believe I unlocked that one and now I figured it out. And, you know, by making Matt a Catholic, Irish Catholic, not just an English, you know, like, that was important, that the nod to Matt's Catholicism is still there. At no point do they specifically say Matt's a Catholic. You just say Matt's Irish.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, oh, yeah, of course. Ah, it's just, God, it's... See, and those are the things that allow me to forgive the Watcher and the time travel, because the rest of it is so perfect.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I think a further read is probably required, because I think there's so much you can miss and there's so much detail. Just in the dialogue alone, there's so many references to other things in the Marvel Universe or perhaps other characters that you don't even get to see in this book. And it's the depth is truly amazing. So what I do want to talk about as well, actually, before we sort of jump too far ahead to the end, is the art in this book. This is sort of next level kind of brilliance. Andy Kubert, who's done other things, like he did Flashpoint, I believe, the DC Flashpoint, which hopefully we'll cover at some point as well.
We had talked about that. We were between the two. I didn't even realize, you're right though, it would have been apparently I had Kubert on the mind.
Exactly. So we'll give you another Kubert fix in a few weeks, don't worry.
That'll be
first
great.
Taste is for free, and then we'll see what happens. The art in this, I mean, I think there's, I was reading, there's some kind of method to it, what they call enhanced pencils, where he would draw it and then rather than send it to an inker, it would go straight to the color artist to give these sort of cleaner and more elaborate lines. I mean, when you read it, it almost looks like, not quite, but has almost a vibe of almost like a painted work from that time period, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, 100%.
Yeah, it does. It helps transport you to that time and place. You know, it doesn't look like, you know, you pick up a comic book today and, you know, whoever it may be, all those wonderful artists, you know, working on the monthly titles, they all look fantastic, but they look contemporary and they look modern. But whereas if you open this and start reading it, it does almost transport you back to 1602, and it looks old fashioned in a good way, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. And it feels dirty in some places. And there's the coloring, as you mentioned, there's some panels where the color fades out, like when you're inside Wanda's visions, the colors will fade a little, and then later towards the end of the book there's some fading where the rest of the colors kind of disappear. It definitely feels lived in, it feels dirty, like, you know, like it should.
It does. It's just a really sumptuous kind of thing to look at. You know, it's deep, and there's so much detail to what he's got in there as well. It has so much character to it. The people feel and look like real people. It really is a sort of a masterwork as far as I'm concerned.
And I think that with thing about him is he manages with Flash, with Wolverine, the thing I knew him best from was that Wolverine stuff from the 80s. That's my favorite drawing of Wolverine, is Kubert's Wolverine, and I think it comes through in his beast in this. It's that the way that they fill space, you know, because Beast, Beast is so big, and yeah. and you forget that, like, you know, especially because he's not blue in this. He's just the human Beast, because that's who Beast was in the early, you know, yeah. X-Men, because that's yeah. what's taking place from. And his Beast, he fills panels in such a way that it's like, and he draws the, you know, because the way that he moves, like he crawls around, he feels double jointed. And it's so, again, making that, what we talked about being grounded in reality. I think Kubert does the fantastical things, the way Beast moves, the way Bobby, like when Bobby's doing stuff, you know, it strains him to like do some of the work that he does. And there's yeah. like a look on his face of consternation as he's trying to concentrate. And that's just, it's really a simple line or two, but he does such a great job of having these people feel like they could really be doing this. It never feels, even though it's a fantastical feat that they're doing, it doesn't feel that way.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It feels like almost like a historical document, if that yeah. makes sense. It's beautifully realized and works so well with the way it's written. It's a perfect synergy. We also can't miss mentioning the covers. Quite often cover art kind of goes by the by and doesn't really get a mention. But the way in which the cover art for these individual issues, and this was done, a gentleman called Scott McKeown or McKeown, however you pronounce it, McCohen, he used a technique called scratchboard, where basically they used a sharp knife or some kind of etching tool, and he would inscribe the images onto white china clay that had been coated in sort of black ink. So in effect, you're scraping black ink off a white background to create these pictures. I'm sure they've been enhanced, you know, digitally after the event, maybe photoshopped or what have you. I wouldn't know, but they are to die for, aren't they? They literally look like art from the 1600s, don't they?
Yeah,
it's, and that's really how amazing.
People, right, and what you described, that's how people used to do printings.
Yeah,
right, because you couldn't. So the way that you did a printing is you made an etching.
Yeah.
And then you would color that, you'd color it, and then you'd print it, and then you'd wipe it clean, and you could color it a different color if you wanted and print it again. And so that's why, like, everything has, you can literally, and I have it digitally, so you can zoom right in. You can see yeah. every etch line yeah. is just gorgeous. Yeah, I mean, I would, if I had the covers, they would be hanging on my wall, like their artwork quality. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's not something you see every day on the pages of Marvel Comics or DC Comics, for that matter. It really does look like it's something someone's taken from an art gallery and
yeah.
put on the page. It really is amazing. I mean, he did.
Yeah, I mean, in the world where I live, where one day there'll be that, you know, when there'll yeah. be the comic book wing and modern art yeah. Museums, you know, early Todd McFarlane Spawn, Jim Lee's Batman, these covers. The other McKeown, Dave McKeown, who did the covers of Sandman, right?
Yeah.
You know, those ones where he did like the multi, like those were all three-dimensional things. Yeah. Like those existed in space and then they somehow took a picture of them.
Yeah.
That's just stunning. It's stunning, real, real, like you said, it's high art, but because it's a picture of Dr. Doom, whole, you know, people like, but man, the effort and time that was put into each one of those is amazing.
It is. It's fantastic. And he did, I think as well, he came back, Cohen, when they did the hardcover edition and produced like a wraparound cover using the same technique.
Oh, oh, oh.
And it's almost like a recreation of the gunpowder plot. Easy for me to say. The gunpowder plot conspirators who almost like the protagonists and this picture were all traitors to King James the VI as well.
Yeah.
So it kind of ties in quite nicely with Guy
That's
Fawkes.
That's amazing.
With Guy Fawkes and his co-conspirators.
Oh.
But that shot of all, you know, you've got Matt Murdock there, you've got Rogers, you've got Peter Parker, you've got Nick Fury there, Virginia. You've got a lot of, about six or eight characters there. And it literally is almost the way they're positioned. It looks just like that old gunpowder plot picture. It's fantastic, isn't it?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I don't have that one.
Right. If
I'll have to look it up.
It's easily accessible.
It's
you know, it's a great picture. It really is. Although Steve Rogers looks the absolute spits of Tom Hamilton, the bass player from Aerosmith.
Yeah. Oh wait, there, I found it. Yeah. Oh my god, he does. Holy crap.
Yeah. It does. It looks exactly the same. At first, I thought it was an Aerosmith album cover. I know they've been around a long time, but I didn't think they've been around that long.
1602, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe Steven Tyler was only about 20 then. But yeah, I mean, just look at that picture. That's, you know, for those who are listening, something. Seek it out. Google it. Look it up. You'll be glad you did. If I could get a print of this, or, you know, a high quality print to put on my wall on canvas at home, if I could find one, I might try and look for one after we finish recording this. It's that good. Yeah. It is brilliant, isn't it? It is fantastic.
Yeah, my favorite, now that I'm looking at this, my favorite cover is the Matt with the arrow.
Yes.
Because the thing about Matt is, everybody's, like you said, Hulk and Spider-Man are the most known Marvel characters. But like you said, the street level characters, because the thing about Matt, and even in this, the love letter to Matt, that Matt could kill James the Sixth and he doesn't.
Yeah.
He just threatens him.
Yeah.
And he creeps in and he's like, it's still that, like, the thing about Matt that he doesn't kill, but he's like, believes in justice and he believes in what's right. And so I've just always been such a fan of Matt Murdock as a character, and, Charlie Cox's performance on the show is just exceptional. And I just think that they really capture him well. So that cover of him where he's like pointing an arrow straight up, but with the red blindfold on, I love that cover so much. But now that I see this wraparound one, I'm like, well, that's amazing.
But yeah, that one of Matt, I think it's issue 4, if I'm not mistaken.
Is
superb. I mean, there's 8 amazing covers there to look at, for one for each issue from the original run and this extra wraparound. So that's 9 wonderful works of art to really enjoy. Like we were saying, you know, cover art kind of gets overlooked for the interior art, really, and more often than not, that's fair enough. But this artwork on the covers is just amazing, and like we're saying about the technique involved as well. I mean, the level of talent to be able to do something like that, it blows my mind. I wish I had one iota of that kind of artistic talent.
It's something. And Neil seems to know how to he always knows with whom to work, right?
Yeah.
He understands the value of what that it's a whole package, that cover matters. And while you may overlook it, it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And that is just as much part of the story, as anything else.
Yeah. Oh, it is. And it kind of tells a story within itself as well, you know.
Yeah. Like the one of Steve and Rogers and Virginia on the new on the ground, and then Nick Fury standing in the water.
Yeah.
Like invading. It was amazing. It's so good.
Yeah, it is. It's just the sort of perfect bow on a wonderful package, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it is completely, absolutely brilliant. Yeah. I mean, it's a shame that it's never been sort of adapted for anything. I read somewhere that Neil Gaiman did actually pitch a live action TV series, you know, for Marvel Television, but was rejected. Whether they thought it'd be too expensive or people wouldn't warm to it, maybe. I don't know, but I can't imagine why no one would want to make this into I don't think it would work as a movie. It would have to be like a mini series on TV, wasn't it? For the amount of storytelling you'd need and the amount of characters you bring.
Yeah, I think you couldn't even do it in 8. I think it would have to be, you know, like a full season. Mm. I think you'd need at least 12 to 15 maybe episodes of TV. And maybe, guys, if they were hour long. It's just there's so much going on, and you have to introduce them.
Yeah.
And we have a lot happening. It would definitely be expensive.
It would, yeah. But you could do it. I mean, obviously, people now are accustomed to, obviously, the actors from the MCU playing the relevant characters. But if you were doing this as a TV show and setting it, then you could, you know, you could employ different actors and actresses to play the parts. You wouldn't be, you know, you wouldn't need to, you know, bring Chris
Although,
Evans up.
Although, if this
up
is the way to keep Charlie Cox as Matt Murdock, this could be a way, because we still don't know if he'll end up on the big screen. The dream is he'll be in Spider-Man 3, right?
But there's talk of it, isn't there? I mean, it would be logical based on what happened. Again, if anyone's not seen Spider-Man Far From Home, shame on you, go and see it. But obviously, the way it ends, Spider-Man's in a lot of trouble, isn't he? He needs a lawyer.
I know. And you thought it too. Yeah.
He's not had a lot of money, has he? So a pro bono lawyer.
I have a weird few degrees of separation from the director of that movie. All right. I know someone who knows John Watts, so maybe I'll just say to her, like, hey, just make sure you sprinkle that in there.
Yeah.
Charlie Cox. Yeah.
See if they can get us some inside track as to what they've got planned for that film, you know.
That would be great. I'll see what I can do. Well, I know that he's like sworn to secrecy most of everything. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean
there is Charlie Cox was in Stardust, so there's a Neil Gaiman connection too. Oh, so we'll fan cast the shit out of this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to see it as a. I was with you rereading it, and you kept referring to it, you know, like as cinematic. It is. Mm. It really does need an adaptation, and I would even be fine. I know Marvel is going to put the What If books out or the What If shows out on Disney.
Yeah, an animated show, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of those those actors are going to come in and voice their own characters.
Yeah, they are.
So, Hayley Atwell is going to be Agent Carter as Captain America.
Yeah.
So, in theory, if you did it animated, you could get those actors. You could get them.
Mm. Yeah, you could do, yeah. Yeah, because it would be a lot of commitment for them, yeah.
Yeah, it'd be a lot easier thing. Of course, we don't have a Fantastic Four.
Well, we're getting one, though, aren't we?
One day.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's going to happen, isn't it?
Now
they have the rights. It's going to happen. You don't sit on a property like that. So I think it's fair to say in the next few years, the Fantastic Four will be in the MCU along with the X-Men as well, obviously. But
I would hope so.
How and when and why they incorporate them remains to be seen. There's a lot of theories about that. But
Ant-Man 3 is my theory.
What's that? Sorry?
Ant-Man.
Oh, like a kind of quantum realmy.
Yeah. My theory. Yeah,
that's where they've been all this time, kind of thing.
Correct.
Right. Yeah, it wouldn't. Yeah, that would explain a lot of things. Yeah, because he said that they might set, when they do a Fantastic Four film, they might actually set it in the 1960s and have their origin done as it was in the 60s comics, and then obviously have them, like you say, stuck somewhere outside of time and space, which explains why they've been, and obviously how they cannot be aged up, and then drop them back in. 2020, whatever year they come out, and they go, oh, hi. But then, perhaps somebody would have remembered them from the 60s.
Somebody would have remembered them. Right? Yeah. Well, the thing, what I love about this is Matt's song that he sings, the Fantastic Four, like the tease that that they may not be in it, but that they're just like legends.
Yeah.
And that, because there's Matt keeps singing this song and he keeps getting interrupted where he's telling the tale of the Fantastic Four. It's so genius. God, again, I could say genius 50 times and it wouldn't be enough to say how smart this book is.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I think on that note, we should go probably to our final scores. We've been waxing lyrical for long enough, I think. As always, people listening to the show know the guest always gets the last word and the big finish. So I'll quickly give my little score here. I'm going to give it 4 out of 5. I'm a massive fan of the book. It has all sort of the big hitters from the Golden Age of Marvel. I think Gaiman does a practically sort of seamless job of rehousing them into a new timeline and incorporating, like we said, into actual historical events. And I love personally Elseworlds and What If stories, so it's right up my street. The art, like we said, is just out of this world. The plot's really well constructed and laid. And it doesn't get 5 for me because, like we said earlier, I'm not overly keen on the time-displaced Captain America part of things. But generally speaking, this is a book for me, and I'm going to give it a very high 4 out of 5, sort of teetering on the brink of a 5, but I'm going to give it a 4. So what did you think, Tony?
I agree with all of your sentiments, and I would, if I could give it a half score, I will go 4.5.
You can do that.
For all those reasons, the Watcher is almost even more problematic than Steve Rogers' time machine.
Yeah.
And I know they're sort of connected, and it's a way, smartly, to keep the 1602 universe intact by creating a pocket universe at the end. But the Watcher characters in Marvel, I've never been a big fan. It's not that I don't necessarily like this spacey stuff, although I'm with you, I prefer the street level comic characters over, the Doctor Strange and the magic stuff. But and some of the space stuff is fine, but I don't know. The Watchers just always kind of felt, hey, DC's got the Guardians, we could do that. And they're almost like 2 on the nose. And I know that's silly because we know Stan Lee is the late great Stan Lee was a huge plagiarist, and he would say, you made an idea, I'm going to make it better. And he acknowledged that. So, and that might be it. It's just, so I just, that, just that But the reason I didn't knock it down a whole point for that is because the way that Doctor Strange has to solve that problem that the Watchers give him and the way he does it is genius. So that's my biggest issue too. But overall, and it's such a lovely retelling of the Marvel Universe, but while also, like you had mentioned and you taught me about those real people, that's even cooler.
Yeah.
So that's why I go for 4.5. But you know, Andy Kubert, you know, whatever he wants to draw is fine. And that, like you mentioned, those covers, that is classic work of art stuff.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It's a great book, and I'm personally delighted that you chose such a great book for the topic of show number 10. So thank you for that. And well, thank you in general, Tony, as always. It's been an absolute honor and a treat and a privilege to have you on as such an esteemed guest. I'm very grateful. If you would, obviously, as always, like to let people know where they can find you and your work and the various spots where you're out there, feel free. Fire away, sir.
Sure. Thank you. So I am on Twitter at Tricycle Boombox, all one word. And I write for DC Comics News. I do, because our good friend El Stevo allows me to drop into Fantastic Universes when my capricious nature allows me. So I appreciate him. So I do post stuff not as regularly as you do on Fantastic Universes. And that is my great shame, but I appreciate him and I love that he lets me put stuff over there. I do audiobook reviews for Audiophile magazine. I was honored to do, I got the Sandman audiobook early from them. So I managed to get to listen to it and write the review for Audiophile magazine. So you can find that out there. And there's links on my website, which is just my initials, arfarina.com. You can go there and I have links to that. And of course, I'm on our network. I'm on the Comics in Motion Network. I'm the Indie Comic Spotlight, of which you've been a guest. And I hope now that you're back in the saddle, I will have you back. So we had talked about maybe doing some Aliens and Predator stuff.
Yes.
Which would be a lot of fun. Now, especially now that Marvel bought them back, we can dig back into that Dark Horse stuff. So that's where you can find me.
Fantastic. If anyone wants to say hello, you can find me on Twitter at Maxi Byrne, which is spelled MaxyByrne. When you go there, you'll see links to the sort of various sites I write for, and obviously the Comics in Motion podcast feed where this show goes out. So, but if you're listening, you probably already know that. But check it out anyway. There's, as Tony said, his brilliant Indie Comics Spotlight show is on there, along with a load of other brilliant shows. Whatever your taste, I think you'll find something on there to tickle your fancy. There's just something for everyone, and it is really a great thing to be a part of. So again, thank you, Tony. Thank you so much for coming on.
It's my pleasure, Max. I always love chatting with you, man.
Yeah, likewise. It's my pleasure and it's my privilege. So thank you so much. And thank you to everyone out there who's been listening. And take care of yourselves in these times. Look after each other. And we'll see you again in episode 11. Bye for now.
Bye.
No want the banana, see for me, me nice.
Me want the body, him want the punani.
I mean, the way nice.
Me want the body, him want the punani.
I mean, the way nice. I mean, the way nice.
I mean, the way nice.
I mean, the way nice.
I mean, the way nice.
I mean, no way nice.
I mean, no way nice.